Think about this for a moment as we begin. As you're going throughout your daily life, have you ever experienced something infinitesimally small? If I even said the word right. That like ruined your day. You ever had that happen? Yesterday, we were at the baseball field in the morning, Luke's game. I'm one of his coaches. I'm sitting there at first base doing the coach thing. And every stinking week, we're out there. I think I tie my shoes up right. I think it's fine. I don't know what it is. It never happens in my left foot, but always my right. Dirt, baseball field dirt, gets in my right shoe, works itself under my foot, and just hangs out by my toes. Why? This is so frustrating because it's very small, right? You're like, Adam, chill out. But hear me, we make a case for not chilling out. It's very small. I think about it every time I put my right foot down to walk. And therefore, I'm thinking about it for like 4 hours every Saturday morning. It's not cool. You'd think when I sit down, I don't have to be out there. When they're up or on the field, that I'd take it out, right? Yeah, I don't do that for some reason. And I don't even do it when I get home. One time I went a whole week, put my foot back in there for the next week. I'm like, there's the rock again. Something so small. Yet something that just ruins your day. Now, think about this. What happens if that little rock or whatever the small thing is for you, if you multiply that by a million, maybe a billion, would it be a very small thing still? No! Something of this is what Pharaoh and all of Egypt face in the third and the fourth plagues. Gnats, flies. Something so small, but a message communicated by God that Pharaoh cannot ignore. The text before us, as we continue on in Exodus, is chapter 8, verse 16 to 32. 2 points, two headings today, plague 3, plague 4. Very simple structure before us. Let's see the text. Plague 3, the gnats, verse 16 to 19. This is what the word says. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth so that it may become gnats in all the land of Egypt. And they did so. Aaron stretched out his hand with his staff, struck the dust of the earth, and there were gnats on man and beast. All the dust of the earth became gnats in all the land of Egypt. The magicians tried by their secret arts to produce gnats, but they could not. So there were gnats on man and beast. Then the magicians said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. Right away, we need to remember, church, there's a pattern to the plagues. Remember, we said this last week. We need to say it again. We'll say it through all these plague moments. The first 9 plagues come in 3 sets of 3. This serves to highlight the most devastating and dreadful final 10th plague. In the first plague, it's always Moses going out to Pharaoh in the morning as he's going out to the water of the Nile. The second plague is always Moses going into Pharaoh's court or palace. The third plague, no warning, it just happens. And that's what we see here as this third plague begins in verse 16. No warning. No visit from Pharaoh or to Pharaoh. No command to let the people go. No warning that if you do not, this will happen. God just instructs Moses and Aaron, do this, and they did. And all of Egypt is covered in gnats. Let's ask some questions about this. First question, does the phrase dust of the earth mean anything to you? It should. This is not the first part or moment in the Bible we've come across this phrase. The first time it occurs is way back in Genesis chapter 13, as God is making his great promise to Abraham. Your descendants shall be like the dust of the earth. What's intended by this, right, we understand, back then, was that Abraham's descendants that would become the nation of Israel will be beyond count. As glorious as that was then, its use in this present moment in the third plague is as devastating for Egypt and all Pharaoh. This is hard to grasp, isn't it? I mean, we know gnats. We live in Florida. We know gnats. One gnat, just bzz, it's gone. Even like 10, 20 gnats. They're just like, ah, I just got to move over here. Just a section. Maybe there's like standing water or something. But gnats like this, that seem to be so thick that you probably couldn't look down and see your hands clearly? To say this is problematic is a massive understatement. Second question. But were they gnats? We've done this every week as we've looked at the Hebrew words and what they are and what they can come over in translation to English. And a real option really could be gnats here. That could be an option for this word. In Hebrew, gnats, little insignificant, buzzing little things. But the Hebrew word, cain, can also refer to, if some of you have the KJV, it's open, lice. Or, you think that's bad, maggots. Some of you were thinking, gnats are not so bad. But now this stuff just became the stuff of nightmares. I mean, lice all over you, laying their eggs, causing you to itch, biting, not just in your hair, everywhere. No thanks. To me, as bad as that is, are not maggots worse? Nasty, oozy, slimy, disgusting little creatures creepily crawling all over you, laying their eggs, doing the thing that they do. Maggots are only present in things that are decomposing, generally. What is God doing to Egypt? He's uncreating it. This is the lesson for us. Creation's full of order and structure and patterns. God is undoing the created order as he's assaulting the proud Pharaoh in Egypt. But it could also be gnats. Gnats, lice, or maggots. Take your pick. You should also know that many here, as just we've seen with the first two plagues, they do with all of them, they try to find a natural explanation for the arising of such an environmental occasion, event. One very popular natural explanation for this is seemingly just right on the heels of the second plague. If all the frogs are dead in Egypt, it makes sense then that there'd be gnats everywhere because there's nothing to eat the gnats anymore. So gnats abound. As logical as that might be, it entirely misses the point. God is working wonders. He is assaulting Egypt, attacking the false gods of Pharaoh's pomp and proud, arrogant heart. And he is pointing out that he is God and no one else is. These are miracles. They are signs. And they are wonders. Third question. Last question. Why gnats? Remember, God's up to far more than just destabilizing the economy of Egypt. He's attacking the gods of Egypt. Here, before us today, in the third and fourth plague, which we'll see soon, God is attacking the Egyptian deity known as Khepri. This is the Egyptian deity that's often symbolized as the powerful and mighty God who takes care of nature's environment. And this God is often depicted in ancient Egyptian literature as a strong body with a scarab beetle head. And so here, God is saying, I'm bigger than Khepri. Where is your Khepri when I am assaulting you? Where are your gods when I have come and rolled up my sleeves to bear my arm? What can your gods do in the face of me? Nothing. They can't do anything. This is all very similar to the first two plagues until we get to verse 18 and 19. Pharaoh's magicians tried before, and they succeeded to duplicate the wonders of God that I argued was by satanic power, the work of the devil. But now here, what do we find? They are unable to duplicate the gnats. For these experts in the secret arts, this defeat was humiliating. Let's pause right here. I've said it before in the first two plagues. I've already said it today. I'll say it again. I think these magicians were doing what they were doing. They were able to do what they were able to do because of the power of the devil. But right here in the third plague, what do we learn about their inability to produce gnats? Church, learn here the limits of the devil's power. Don't get me wrong, the devil has power. He has the power to rebel, to tempt, to deceive, to accuse, to hold captive, to afflict, to oppress, to oppose, to destroy our earthly bodies. But there's a whole host of things that Satan cannot do. He cannot create. He cannot redeem. He cannot love. He cannot be humble. He cannot undo what God does. He cannot go where he desires to go, being that he is a being subject to God's sovereign pleasure. So like a dog on a leash, the devil serves the Lord's designs. All his evil proves to be an instrument for the bringing about of things far more lovely than he ever wished. This third plague is a defeat for Satan, as his servants could not create gnats. But the devil's greatest defeat was still to come, wasn't it? It would come one day, on the best of all days, on resurrection morning. He thought he won his greatest battle when the Son of God entered into the tomb dead. He had lived. He had come into this world. He had lived. He had died. And when he entered the tomb, all hell rejoiced, and Satan gains a vile, pleasurable smile and grin, thinking that he has won. But the Son who died was the Son who rose. And in his rising, he publicly put to shame the devil and all his demons. And he led a host of captives free from the devil's power. These captives would one day come to believe in this Son. This was the greatest victory in the history of the world. It was the greatest defeat of the devil, where he was defanged. We must remember this, church. We, as Christians, we don't just face hard times, struggles, seasons of hardship and difficulty. We contend with an enemy. We contend with an enemy who is not resting. So remember, Satan is potent, but he's not omnipotent. He is wise, but he is not omniscient. He is present, but he is not omnipresent. God is stronger. God can deliver us from evil. God can enable us to stand. And God can keep us safe in his arms. What we see here in the third plague is meant to bolster us in the fight. So be encouraged, church. Yes, you are in a battle. We are in a battle. But we only contend with a defeated foe. Thank you, sir. Back to the narrative. After these magicians admitted defeat, they told Pharaoh the last thing that he wanted to hear in verse 19. You see it? This is the finger of God. Before, in the text, we have read and heard, this is God's outstretched arm, his mighty hand. You see the descent? It's his finger. How great a power is held in just the finger of God. We might initially think, hearing this from the magicians, that this is some kind of conversion or confession of belief in the God of Israel. It's not. The word there used for God is just a generic term that they would have used themselves to talk about their own gods. So what are they really saying? This is the finger of God. They're saying a power greater than theirs has proven stronger than their magic. They're admitting that they're in a spiritual battle and that they're losing. They're admitting that these gnats are of divine origin and they cannot duplicate divinity. Yet, even this confession doesn't sway Pharaoh. As verse 19 ends, we see the sad tale continue. Due to the hardness of his heart, he remains fixed and firm in his unbelief, in his resistance to the Lord's commands. That's the third plague. Now see plague 4. We've seen the gnats. Now we know who the real Lord of the Flies is. We'll start with verse 20 to 24. Listen to the word. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Rise up early in the morning and present yourself to Pharaoh as he goes out to the water, and say to him, Thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. Or else, if you will not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of flies on you and your servants and your people and into your houses. And the houses of the Egyptians shall be filled with swarms of flies. And also the ground on which they stand. But on that day I will set apart the land of Goshen, where my people dwell, so that no swarms of flies shall be there. That you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the earth. Thus I will put a division between my people and your people. Tomorrow the sign shall happen. And the Lord did so. There came a great swarms of flies into the house of Pharaoh and into his servants' houses throughout all the land of Egypt. The land was ruined by the swarms of flies. Remember the pattern of the plagues. What do we see as this fourth one begins? Moses, just as the first plague, goes out to Pharaoh in the morning as he's going out to the water. Remember, that God's already been defeated in plague one. The Nile turned to blood. Happy! Is Pharaoh still just going through the motions of worshiping a defeated God? Probably. But this lets us know the second cycle of plagues has now begun. And I bet Pharaoh would have thought, as he's going out into the water that morning, watching Moses come, oh boy. Here we go again. I remember the last time this happened. And he'd be right to think this. God is not done. For the sixth time, Pharaoh hears the command of the Lord. Let my people go. And this time the warning, if he refuses, is all the more severe. Flies. God will send swarms of flies to Egypt. The word flies might really mean flies here. Hope I'm not going to gross you out again like lice and maggots. But the word flies, you should know, is a general term referring to all manner of small flying insects, the biting and non-biting persuasions. I remember when my little sister, Meredith, got married down in Longboat Key at a wonderful resort there. We had the rehearsal dinner. It was on a Friday night. It was June or July. It was like 8 p.m. We're all right out there on the water. It was only like 2 hours. We're out there, like, there's some dinner, there's some dancing. Everybody go home for tomorrow, right? That's what a rehearsal dinner is. There were moments where I was like, oh, man, I'm kind of itchy. What is going on? I was like, didn't think about it. Another song comes on. We're all dancing. It's fun time. Leave. Holly and I leave. Go back to our room. Go to bed. I wake up, 3 a.m., my skin is on fire. I don't know why, but my legs, like my knees to my ankles, feel like they're burning. So I look down. I'm like, what is happening? Are there bed bugs? No. There were bugs all throughout that rehearsal dinner. The no-see-ums got us. There was not a millimeter of leg skin that was not covered with a red bite. And so I jumped in the bathtub and filled it up with cold water. It was the only thing I could think of to get relief. We went to the wedding the next day, drove home to Atlanta at that time, fire itching for 8 hours straight in the car. It was wonderful. It's one of the worst memories we have on such a wonderful occasion. If you have experienced something like this with Noceums or something of the like, you know what Egypt, again, multiply it by a million or a billion, this is what they're currently experiencing. If you think I'm overstating my case, Psalm 78 talks about this moment. The psalmist in Psalm 78, verse 45, says, God sent swarms of flies to Egypt. And then the psalm says this, they devoured them. These were definitely of the biting persuasion. That's what we're meant to glean. We read that, we go back and we're like, oh my, oh my. This is awful. This is awful. It's not just one fly, two flies, 10 flies. This is a swarm. Remember, that's a good word in Genesis 1. Let all the living creatures swarm on the earth. And they all filled the earth. Here, just as the frogs swarmed all of Egypt, now the flies swarm as well into every nook and cranny. But, my oh my, this is so wonderful. Something new here happens too. In verse 22 and 23, you see it? God makes a divine distinction. What a moment, church, to see. The flies in the fourth plague will not touch his people at all. They will cover Egypt, every Egyptian, baby to senior, covered in flies, every Israelite, not one fly. Why does God do this? Why make the division? Was it because Israel was just so wonderful in themselves? They worked really hard and put forward enough effort to earn God's protection? No. Israel was and would remain to be the stubborn, stiff-necked, sinful people that they are. So their own works and effort are not in view, which begs the question, why? Why did God make such a divine distinction? One answer we could give is God is a God who makes division. The days of creation, there was division there. Day one is not day two. It's not day three, four, five, six. And the eternal day seven, God made a division between male and female. God made a division between all the families on the earth and Noah's family. He made a division between all the families on the earth and the family of Abraham that would become the nation of Israel. Among all the nations, God chose Israel. God is a God who makes division. That's one answer we could say. But a better answer that gets further to the truth, God makes the divine distinction between the Israelites and the Egyptians in the fourth plague because of covenant reality. Why did God do the Exodus at all? Back in chapter 2, he heard their groaning. What did he do? Remembered his covenant. And so in remembering, what did he do? Sent Moses to save his people. Covenant is their assurance that God will protect them. Deuteronomy 7, God speaking to Israel, says this so well. It was not because you were more in number than any other people that I set my love on you and chose you. You were the fewest of all the peoples, but it is because I love you that I am keeping the oath that I swore to your fathers, covenant. that I have brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from slavery from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore, Deuteronomy 7:9, know therefore that the Lord your God, He is God, faithful, keeping covenant forever. God made the distinction because of covenant. Covenant is the guarantee. Covenant is the pledge. It is the assurance that God will always be God to His people, despite His people. That's what we see. How wonderful of a reality for us to know that in the new covenant, just like the old here, that reality still exists. That eternally, we are forever safe in the arms of our God. That He will always be God to us. And we will always be His people. Not because of us. Look at us. But because of Him and His grace and His pursuit. This is firmness to put fallen feet on. This will steady a shaken soul. Avail yourself of the covenant. That's not the end of our text. We see it end in verse 25 to 32. Look what happens here. Then Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and said, "Go sacrifice to your God within the land." But Moses said, "It would not be right to do so, for the offerings we shall sacrifice to the Lord our God are an abomination to the Egyptians. If we sacrifice offerings abominable to the Egyptians before their eyes, will they not stone us? We must go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as He tells us." So Pharaoh said, "I will let you go to sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only, you must not go very far away. Plead for me." Then Moses said, "Behold, I am going out from you, and I will plead with the Lord that the swarms of flies may depart from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people tomorrow. Only, let not Pharaoh cheat again by not letting the people go to sacrifice to the Lord." So Moses went out from Pharaoh and prayed to the Lord. And the Lord did as Moses asked and removed the swarms of flies from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people. Not one remained. But Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also and did not let the people go. You notice here, as this passage wraps up, what does Pharaoh not do? He doesn't call in the magicians. They've already failed. He knows they couldn't do the gnats. He certainly knows they're not going to do flies. It's actually an interesting point. From this point on, as the magicians depart from the scene of the story, so does Aaron. Aaron's not even referred to now here either. It seems to be a contest solely from here on out in the plagues, Moses versus Pharaoh. What God is going to prove the stronger? Interesting shift there we see. Instead of calling the magicians, Pharaoh tries to bargain. He gives up some ground. He says, "You can do your sacrifices here, that's fine." But then Moses is like, "No, we can't. You'll kill us if we do that. All our identity and all our worship, our sacrifices, the things that you hold sacred, you'd stone us. We can't do that." And so Pharaoh's like, "Fine." He gives up more ground. "You can go. Just don't go very far." But Moses knows this guy now. He can't be trusted. He can't be taken at his word. Don't cheat again by not letting the people go. Fine. Just get out. But pray for me. And Moses does. He leaves, he prays, and God removes the flies in a moment. Can you imagine all the screaming that just stopped? Can you imagine all the red spots starting to appear? After Pharaoh saw this, he did what we know he was going to do, because God has told us about the hardness of his heart. God's at work here, but so is Pharaoh. You see it? This time Pharaoh hardened his heart also, which means he's been doing it all along. And he did not let the people go. That is the fourth plague. So today, gnats and flies. Maybe gnats. Maybe lice. Maybe maggots. Maybe no-see-ums. The smallest of creatures to humiliate the greatest of empires and kings. How ironic. And we enjoyed God's line drawn in the sand around Goshen. The wall that kept his people safe. The divine distinction. We enjoyed the magician's inability to duplicate any of this. And their confession, this is the finger of God. The power exposed the devil as limited and finite before an infinite God. The most urgent question for us today, of all the many we could ask from this text, I want to talk about Goshen. That line. The distinction God has made. He set his people apart. Church, is this not also what's happened to us? Right? We were enslaved to sin. A greater slavery to a greater Pharaoh in the devil. And we could not free ourselves from this slavery. So what happened? Christmas happened. The indictment on all humanity. They couldn't do it. So I did it for them. God came and he redeemed. And he rescued, and he set his church apart in the world, but not of the world. Out of the world, but still among the world. We are a people that are to be set apart, called out of darkness into not just light, into marvelous light. All of that, I think, is seen in Goshen, the set-apart land that's not even touched by a fly. When you look about your life every day, does your life resemble Egypt and all the mess it is right now, or Goshen? Does it resemble the world and all the ruin? Or is it set apart? It's a very simple application here. Christians, be who you are. You have been set apart. You have been brought into an eternal kingdom that has a king who reigns and rules forever. His covenant is not a suggestion. It is a declaration of ownership. He owns us. We are His. Live like it. Christians, you have been called by this King, and you have been set apart. Be who you are. From doing this, may the world say, from watching us, that is the finger of God.